Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 21, Interview with Jason Barron. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that makes you want to be a talebearer, a torchbearer. And you know what? You don't want a forebear this podcast ever, ever, ever.
Okay, three bears.
You betcha.
Is there a mama bear? A baby bear?
No, and who would Goldilocks be? That'd be Dee Dee. No.
It's not a bear here. Well, we're going to be talking about the Bear Grease today, the John Bear Grease race.
That's it. And dear, I had to make it real easy on you because you've been hibernating for 6 months and
yes.
You wouldn't do a podcast, so I had to choose bear.
It's not that I wouldn't do it. We just got very busy. You know how life gets in the way. So we're back. And we're starting back up, so we got our first interview today.
We've come out of our dens, and we are ready to give you all a bear hug.
The problem is I didn't lose any weight. That's my... Anyway, so we've got a great interview
today. You are more bearable, though.
Brooch. Yes.
Okay, so the John Bear Grease was only part of it.
Yes.
What was the rest of it? And it didn't really have anything to do with hibernating, but it does because
it's Jason Barron.
Yes, and
go.
I got the idea because his website is kind of bear... Enterprises.
Yeah.
So
great website, great interview with Jason. We're gonna have a great conversation today. Let's see how many times I can use the word great. But it's a really interesting conversation. Not only does he have some fantastic stories that he's gonna share with us, but a fantastic public speaker. Really looking forward to seeing him live in Mancelona this year. If you listen to this before August, you'll be hearing he and Dee Dee Jonro and Ryan Reddington at the
Rustic Acres Last Chance Kennel in Mancelona, Michigan. It'll be on August 7th through 10th, 2009.
Yep, it's called the Musher Meetup. Sherry and Russ Sotheby do this every year. They just, I don't know where they get their energy because they put this huge event together to really share experiences, ideas, and just to forge new friendships with mushers and other folks that love the sport of mushing. So they invite everybody up to their 40-acre ranch up in Mancelona, Michigan, which is a couple hours south of the bridge. We recommend it to everybody. Anybody that can possibly get to this, it's very inexpensive. You can get to their website at the
russ-stickacres.com.
So that's russstickacres.com. I like that.
And then /meet-the-mushers-2009 event. And so that's kind of how we stumbled on Jason Barron when we saw that lineup, and I knew that he had won the Bear Grease, and we haven't done anything on the Bear Grease or like the Can-Am, and that's our goal this year is to kind of grab some of those other races. However, one of our other upcoming interviews is on the Iditarod again,
yep.
But the other races we want to make sure we cover. So we kind of stumbled on to Jason Barron.
Yeah, we're going to be covering...
And he kind of really just gave us a great interview, so I know you guys are going to love it.
Yeah, Jason is one of those people that you can just hear his passion elude from him as he's talking. The stories and the excitement of racing. And also, you know, I've been trying to get in for the last 20 episodes trying to understand what makes the competitive musher the competitive musher. And to listen to Jason really just elude competitiveness. And you can just hear it in his voice that he loves to race and he loves to compete. And he just wants people to compete against him because it's exciting for him. And it really is. It's a pushing event that pushes himself and others. So it's kind of cool.
Yep. And before we get started, though, dear, we have to talk a little bit about mail. Now, we don't have everybody. You guys, we've gotten a ton of emails. And we thank you all for your concern. Making sure we're still alive.
Yes. All is okay.
And honestly, it took us so long to get our last interview out, Eagle Ellis, that we kind of knew the writing was on the wall for the winter, didn't we?
It
took us so long to get it out, we thought, okay, we're just done. So we didn't really mean to scare anybody. But we are back. A couple of hits I wanted to talk about. We got one email from Taylor Hirsch trying to understand if he wanted to pick up some sibes to begin racing or if he wanted to do some pointer crosses. And so we say, thanks for contacting us, Taylor. Glad you're listening. And also a Curtis Kuchel, who's a bike juror. And
yeah, a lot of bike jurors getting into it
these
days.
He was a little concerned that there was nothing going on. But so we're here. And we got some really great information from some friends down in South Carolina. So thank you. And we looked over your information, and we'll be working on that. So.
And even a shout out to our friends down in the Cape Town, South Africa, where we have some friends that listen to the show and are actually moving up to the United States. A lot of exciting folks out there from around the world that listen,
yeah.
And so we want to thank
awesome.
You. About 14,000 listeners, so it's kind of exciting. So, fun stuff. So, let's get into the interview. Hey, so welcome, Jason. Thank you so much for taking your time to meet with us today. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and it's just a privilege to get to do something like this with you guys. I'm excited. As I say, the format's wonderful, and I think your show is very entertaining, and I'm just honored to be a part of it.
Great. Jason, tell us a little bit about where you live now.
Well, my wife and I, and my daughter, Oksana, Harmony's my wife, we live in Lincoln, Montana, and that's just a little ways below the Continental Divide, and we're up at about 5,000 feet up in the mountains, and I say from Lincoln, but we're actually about 11 miles out of town. We're very rural. You can't see any neighbors, and very much out in the country. We don't have power. We don't have running water. We have to conserve our resources very carefully. This winter, especially with winter seemed to be kind of intensifying the last few years, we got snowed out. I actually got to the point where we didn't have a snow machine. My four-wheeler couldn't keep the trails in, and we got snowed out about a mile from our house during the heaviest part of training and race preparation. And wow. We live very simply and very ruggedly.
Wow, I'm just sitting here in awe.
I was back at the no water.
No power, no water.
And I carry a bucket to the kennel. Mm.
We have a well, but the reason we don't running water is we can get a generator going. The house is set up, it's a cabin. We're set up to where it's sort of like, think of it like an RV. We have a cistern that you can turn a generator on, pump water out of a well into a cistern, and then pump out of the cistern to, you know, things like the toilet and the sink. And so we do have water, and we're not just doing the paper plates thing. But it just, we're set up more like an RV, I guess, 12-volt lights, you know. And then when the generator comes on, we can turn on the TV and run the computer and things of that nature. But very simple.
Awesome.
Fantastic. You haven't lived there too long, and you came from Alaska originally. What brought you down?
Harm and I bought the property in 1999, and Conabear Enterprises, that's our kennel, our business. And also, the Harm's maiden name was Knovel, and of course, my name is Baron, and Conabear Enterprises, just being kind of clever there. We started the business back in 2000, but actually we moved down from Alaska because we were just seeking new adventure. My wife was born and raised in Northern California, and I was a lifelong Alaskan. I'd been in Alaska up until I was 23, so I mean, I had many adventures and you know, just that whole Iditarod tradition up there. Grew up in a Iditarod family, and by the time I was 23 and had met Harm and we were together, it was just time for new adventures. I mean, we knew we wanted to keep on running dogs and pursue a future kennel together. That was a no-brainer. So really the case once we left Alaska was to, you know, was to find a way to sort of have a place where we could kind of have our cake and eat it too, you know, the trails, winter, you know, of course, here we are in Montana, but also just proximity to other things, that other places and things and people that we just were kind of cut off to growing up. So really this is just a way for us to extend the adventure. I wouldn't be surprised if a few years from now we don't pick a new area just to go and say, well, hey, we can run dogs there. Let's go live there for 10 years.
Great.
That's what I was wondering is, I guess there's a few large kennels in Montana. Is it a wonderful place to run, or is it a...
Oh, yeah, that's a great place to run. Oh, absolutely. You know, we don't have the support network that Minnesota, Michigan, and Alaska have. Not even close. We are kind of scattered. Montana's a big state, and we are kind of scattered around. But the trails are wonderful, geographically speaking. I mean, it's the epic mountains and long valleys, and you can get a variety of different skill sets built into your team just by, you know, by running on these trails if you're dedicated. There's some difficulties that pose on us. I mean, going up to race in Alaska, which we do, you know, most of our career has been based on that, is very difficult because of the distance and the time and, of course, now the fuel costs and all that going up. But moving to Montana wasn't a choice to say, look, let's go there and that's the best place to run dogs. I think it's a fantastic place to run dogs. You can't really go wrong training here. But that wasn't the motivation to move down here. The motivation really had more to do with family, and Harm's family all kind of lives in California and Oregon, and now in kind of scattered around in New Mexico and Texas, and it's just like we can road trip and see some of her family members now, whereas before when we were in Alaska, we just felt a little more isolated. So moving down here was, you know, it wasn't a case of, oh, well, you know, it's a better place to train. Not at all. There's more to life than dog mushing.
Absolutely.
Wow, really? Yeah.
Absolutely.
A lot of people would be surprised to hear me say that, so I'm just saying it. Oh. You don't have to be surprised anymore.
has been said.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an all-inclusive where we're all so busy with the kennels, but yet at the same point, we know that's just part of life, not life itself. So
I characterize dog mushing as secondary. It's probably second in the queue of things that I am. First and foremost, you know, I'm a family man, I'm a father and a husband, and those are the things that I'm the most. And then, you know, being a dog musher, that's the passion, and it's a job.
Right.
Right. And tell us a little bit about your daughter.
My daughter, her name is Oksana Sabelle Barron, and she gave herself a nickname that we call her by more than Oksana. Her name, she called herself Tinka at about a year old, and so she's always Tinka now.
Okay.
And very hyper intelligent. She can recognize more dog breeds than I can by a factor of about 5, probably. She turns 3 in the end of August, and she's just an incredible inspiration to me and my wife. And I just can't even imagine life without her. She just brings us a constant joy.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
And tell us now about your kennel. Now, are you like a full-time musher, or is the kennel your main business, or do you have something outside of that?
I'm a full-time musher. We started the kennel. Harm and I were inseparable on the trail. We would train and race together. I mean, it's one of those things where typically we would have, one of us would have the younger team and the B team or whatever, and somebody would have the A team, the alpha team. But that kind of came to a halt when Harm got pregnant with Oksana, and now she's pregnant again. She's due to have another baby in July. The last few years, I've been doing the solo thing. Harm's been kind of, you know, keeping up with chores and helping out, like, at the home base. But I went from having somebody who was helping me train and race to basically just home support. And that was a real kind of a shift for me. But, yes, the kennels are 100%. This is our business. This is what we do.
Fantastic. So tell us about that. It's obviously, do you sell puppies, or is it all race money that you live on?
No, because that'd be pretty feast or famine, especially with purses going down, the economy's kind of going in the tank. I mean, there's a lot of problems there. You have to be very creative. Selling dogs, I give classes, and I'm trying to build that business up a bit. And it's not just to dog mushers. I'd like to give classes to people who are just enthusiasts and would like to see kind of what we go through. A lot of this is sort of centered in the summer and the fall months when it's easier to kind of put someone on the four-wheeler and take them out and show them what's going on. I'm trying to arrange a little circuit through Montana here where I go to place businesses in various cities around Montana and give a demonstration, essentially kind of a sort of a entertainment / educational presentation a couple times a week at various parking lot of Home Depot, so people coming in can just kind of get an idea of what we're, not so much what we are doing, but what dog mushers are doing, and just educate people a little bit. And it's a way to make a little extra money and keep things rolling along during the off season. And you know, dog sales and leasing consultations. My wife actually is developing a business that's kind of related here, where she does pet portraits. She's a fantastic artist. She's trying to develop a business where she can get people to send her the photographs of their favorite pet, horse, dog, what have you, and she can put together just a high quality, like lifelike portrait of that dog. And that's why it's Conabear Enterprises. We didn't just go with the kennel. We have a number of services that we provide, and people can find out more about us on our website, conabearenterprises.com, and the Conabear is Kanabear Enterprises, all one word, .com, and there are just a number of services. I mean, to some extent, you go to the site, and it's kind of look at me, you know, sort of site. It's like, here's what we've done, and here's what we plan to do with our racing. But also, we just got it up and running about 2 weeks ago, and it's sort of morphing on a daily basis. So there's a lot of stuff in there where it's going to be educational and for dog mushers, for people who just, you know, have an interest and just want to curious about what dog mushing is all about, they did a rod, and so forth. And you go to that site, you're going to find a lot of good stories, training tips, you know, some of our family history, some good photos. It's going to be a really rich site, and it's already looking very nice. I visited
it. It is.
Well, you know, I'm stuck right now. I'm looking at the pet portraits, so I think I found my spot where I like to live. You know, you run a lot of different races, and we hear so much about the Iditarod. A lot of the other races, I don't know if they get overlooked, but we just don't hear as much about them. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe some of your favorite races outside of the Iditarod, and maybe, you know, tell us a little bit about the Bear Grease also?
Oh, sure. You know, that's the thing, and I think it is kind of frustrating, and rightfully so, for drivers who don't go to the Iditarod, and they have all these achievements at these fantastic races like the Bear Grease. It's a 400-mile race in Minnesota. You got the UP in the 200, which is actually closer to 250, Michigan, and then, you know, the Can-Am. It's another rich and very well-historied, tough race of fantastic competitors. And the thing is, they get kind of overlooked by the mass market media simply because they aren't 1,000-mile, don't have a budget of $1 million, et cetera. But they're very worthy races, and actually some of my favorite, the Bear Grease in particular, is a race that I just found our niche there. That one there has got a long history. I mean, it's been around for a long time now. It's 400 miles long. It's got a fantastic laid-out trail, well-marked. It's a tough geography. It's a very demanding trail. It has, there's a lot of strategy that can be employed on that race. It's wonderful competitors. People, you know, come from all over the country to race that race. It used to be, you'd get a lot of Alaskan competitors would come down as well, but, you know, of course, fuel was a lot cheaper in those days, basically. It's a long ways to drive for an Alaskan just to do a middle distance race. But it's just a race that really, you know, if you set that distance aspect aside, would attract just about anybody who had a professional team and wanted to kind of show it off.
What do you like about that race? I know we've got a lot of friends that run it too, and each one of them's got something a little bit different. But what do you like so much about that race?
Well, number one, as a professional, I appreciate the fact that it is a pure race where they give you a 400-mile course. It's actually about 390. They give you a almost 400-mile course and then kind of step out of your way. It's a very well-vetted race, and there's a lot of oversight in that department. But essentially what they do is they kind of get out of your way, and they just say, look, go and race. Go and show your skills and show your genetics. Show your tactics and let the best team prevail. And because of the way that the race is laid out, the format, the mandatory rest, there's quite a bit of mandatory rest. And what it does is it allows for a team to go there and say, have a 1,500-mile training season. And I really appreciate this quality. You can have a 1,500-mile training season cycle and go there and have a particular strategy at the Bear Grease, like you're going to run fast, for instance. You're focusing more on speed, like a lope, extended lope. Or you can have the 3,000-mile training season and cycle, like I kind of prefer for myself, and have a team that's just sort of focused more on a steady pace and quite a bit under that lope. And the thing is that they kind of cancel each other out. There's enough rest that kind of physically, from an endurance standpoint, and mandatory rest that enables the teams to kind of keep up a high rate of speed around that course. On the other hand, what kind of cancels it out and makes it more interesting from a strategic position and from the fans, you know, watching this and seeing how it's all going to come out, is that the trail is difficult enough, it is long enough that the slower, steady, methodical approach has a very legitimate opportunity to prevail there. You have this kind of palette where you can just reach in there, grab big gobs of paint, you know, create your piece of art. And I really appreciate that in any race. I mean, I always evaluate races by saying, look, how much freedom do they give me to express myself and let my dogs express themselves? And I think that's really a great aspect of the Bear Grease, that it allows a number of different people and tactics and genetic programs to show their stuff.
So is this, in a sense, when you keep saying that there's mandatory rests, is that a stage race?
Well, no. The stage race would be, you know, think Tour de France or Rocky Mountain Stage Stop. It's a fantastic race that I don't personally do, but I can appreciate from afar. That is you run today 40, 50, 30 miles or whatever, and then you take the day off, and tomorrow morning you take the team out and go do the next stage, and then keep on going through the progression like that. Same thing as like bike racing, stage racing, Tour de France, things of that nature. The Bear Grease, you've got the 400 miles, there's X amount of checkpoints. It's an up and back trail. You go out, turn around, and come back, which is kind of interesting because it allows you to really be thinking about your strategy on the way back. Whereas, you know, some races you have no idea what you're going to be running into on the home stretch. This race you can really kind of hone in on what you need to do just with your dogs. You don't have to worry about the trail so much. That last year it was 28 hours of mandatory rest that you had to take, and there's two places that that mandate that you have to stop. There's a checkpoint about 135 miles into the race from the beginning, so we go 135 miles with several other stops in between, but there's one spot where you have to stop, the Sawbill, upbound, and there's a four-hour mandatory rest on that, and you can take more, but that's what your mandatory is. And then on the way back down, about 38, 42 miles, something about 40 miles from the finish line in Duluth is a checkpoint called, I think they call it Highway 2. I always call it Two Harbors, but that's a town that's near it. I think it's Highway 2, and there's a six-hour mandatory there. So when I say there's 28 hours of mandatory rest, you kind of have to look at it like you take those 10 hours out that I just mentioned, the four at Sawbill, the six at Highway 2, and then you take the other 18, if I did my math right, the other 18 is sort of floating around. You can stop, and there's a lot of checkpoints, a lot of places that you can make runs that blow these checkpoints and just make a long run together, you know, or you can go leg by leg and take a lot of little breaks, or, you know, that's what I mean by there's a lot of strategy and a lot of opportunity to employ tactics. So you have this other 18 hours kind of floating around. And typically what happens is it's a long trail. You know, 400 miles is a long ways to go. And what people have a tendency to do is go short runs, 40, 50 miles, and take short breaks. So you're never doing the stage stop thing. You don't really get an opportunity to give your dogs this 9, 12-hour break, you know, because it's just, you're kind of penalized if you do that. You do have to go very, very, very fast. And it's my opinion that that race is tough enough course that you're kind of punished. You know, in some ways, I feel like I've succeeded over my rivals there because I don't let my dogs go. I do employ the slow, methodical approach when I manage the team, and that's how I've succeeded twice winning that race. But that doesn't mean that I don't think there's the possibility somebody with a particularly nice loping team couldn't give me more of a challenge than we've seen. It's just that when you go 40, 50 miles, it takes you 4 hours to do it or whatever, and you give your dogs a 3 or 4 hour break, you don't have that stage stop electricity going back through your team when you get going again. I mean, you may look good for the first couple runs, but after a couple days, the race took me 72 hours this year. You know, after 48 hours on the trail, whether you're broke dead up running and resting, your dogs don't do the stage stop thing. They're not a fresh sprint team anymore.
Right.
So looking at that, the last 2 years you've won it. Did you have two different strategies, two different years, or was it the same strategy that worked for both years?
Well, that's a good question. You know, let's put it this way. The first year I went there, 2008, you know, it was all just a theory and a hypothesis for me. You know, I put together, you know, friends and colleagues like such as Doug Swingley. My father's been there a few times, and Cliff Wang as a prior, multiple champion of the Bear Grease. I mean, I had all this input. There's all these people who gave us lots of advice. Dan Bergerson, who's a just lifelong Minnesotan former dog musher out there. He's actually like our logistics guy when we're in Minnesota, and he's one of my handlers. Fantastic advice. I mean, I had all this advice, but there's no replacement for eyes on the course yourself. And when I went in there, I had a fuzzy idea of what my strategy would be, but a lot of it was based on this. In 2008, a lot of it was based on, well, I get in the race, and I, you know, everyone's telling me how tough it is, but we'll see. And at first, I wasn't all that impressed with how tough the race was because, you know, it's a hard, fast trail, and, you know, you're on this groomed snowmobile trail that's 10 feet wide from one end to the other. It wasn't really initially apparent to me how tough the course was because it seemed kind of easy on the surface. But what happened was after about 24 hours, I could see where the dogs never get a chance to, sandbag a little bit. An important concept in distance racing, and this is one that particularly people who race over 300 miles are going to understand, is that a very important quality in distance racing is the ability for the dogs to sandbag a little bit, to spend 3 or 4 hours on a run, covering some ground, but also kind of resting and recharging while they're doing it. And what helps them do that is big, long, mountainous climbs where, sure, they have to pull kind of hard, but their bodies aren't being stressed out like they would on a hard, fast trail where their RPMs are a little higher. Or even just even if it's flat, just soft, kind of slow conditions where the sled's dragging kind of hard and they're punching in a little bit and your RPMs come way down. The thing that was difficult and became apparent to me after about 24 hours in the first Bear Grease that I won was that the pace wasn't going to slow down. It wasn't going to be easier. I wasn't going to get 3 hours where the dogs could just kind of go along and take it easy. So all of a sudden, after about 24 hours, I realized, you know, I'm going to get in trouble if I'm not careful. I had kind of a loping team that year. I was sort of speeding them up and trying some new things. And long story short, was I modified my plan on the fly. I went in there and I really sort of brought on the air brakes and slowed down. And so my sort of yes and no to your first question is, if I haven't lost the audience with a lengthy explanation, is that I had to change my tactics and my implementation of my tactics on the course, but my overall strategy really didn't change that much. And from a rest perspective, I went into the race, and most people in a middle distance race or a lot of races, they go, let's cut the rest early and save a lot of that mandatory rest for the second half when we need it. I'm just the opposite. I have a tendency to say, look, if I'm only going to go 9.5 miles an hour from start to finish, I'm going to bulk up on all my rest early. I'll burn up most of that mandatory rest early, and I'll save very little of my mandatory rest, the floating aspect of it, for the second half. And when I'm on the homeward stretch, is that if I make a 100-mile run, my dogs, once they're tuned in and they've had a chance to kind of settle down and to get race hardened a bit, they're going to go 100 miles at 9.5 miles an hour, regardless of how much rest I give them in the middle or on either end of it. Whereas usually I found that you do the most damage to your team in the first half of any race, especially if it's a hard, fast trail, almost certainly if it's a hard, fast trail. So in that regard, that's how I ran the race in 08, and I had to modify it a little bit in 2009 because they added 40 miles of trail and took 4 hours of the mandatory rest away. It was 32 hours of mandatory and Well, there was, you can imagine, that's a significant change. 4 less hours plus 45 more miles. So I modified it, but it really came down to the same thing. I bulked up, burnt up most of my rest in the first half of the race, and turned around and just made epic push compared to my competitors. I just made a couple of epic pushes to the finish line, and it won me the race by... I physically came in 1 hour in front of second place, but I was able to outrun them on trail time overall by 2 hours. And it's kind of a weird thing. Most people don't realize it's happening in the Bear Grease when you look at the statistics. The first half of the race, I'm getting just mercifully beat up. The first year I ran in 2008, the word went out that, well, I was done. My goose was cooked before I even got to the halfway point. Oh, he's, you know, everybody heard that I was going to be in the race, and of course I was going to be one of the favorites. And then after the first day, it was like, oh, well, Barron didn't bring anything.
He's out.
And then I was able, when I sort of like make that big push to the finish line, it's so unorthodox. Nobody else runs the race that way. It catches everybody by surprise. And I'm literally sitting at Two Harbors, 6 hour mandatory layover, so nobody can kind of cut rest to catch up with me with a dominant lead and an overpowering strategic position that nobody can do anything about, and jaws are on the ground because they're like, where'd this come from? Nobody's even seen me on the race because I'm hanging so far back. And then, which is more a function of pace, but it's probably more a function of the how I allocated the rest. And then in 2009, which is this year, I kind of did a variation on that. I ran really slow, and people ran off and left me for the first half, and then teams kind of all fell by the wayside, and, you know, a lot of them scratched, and the ones that didn't scratch just fell off the pace, and I was able to kind of go on to a particularly dominant victory. So when I say that I think that the Bear Grease formula allows for a variety of different techniques, I will say also to qualify that the technique that seems to be working for me is the methodical, very disciplined, very conservative approach.
Jason, okay, so if you compare that with maybe the Can-Am or the UP200, do you have to have a completely different strategy for the different races because they're so much different in not only the length but also the competitors?
Yeah, you see a lot of the same competitors come to both races. So the fellow who beat me in the Can-Am, Matt Carstens, is a driver for Navajo Home Kennels, very, very high-powered kennel there. He was in the Bear Grease, and Eric Morris, the fellow who won the UP, was not in the Bear Grease, but he kind of has a cooperative thing going with John Stetson, who was my second place. He was a runner-up in the Bear Grease. I mean, there's a lot of connections. Ryan Anderson was second place in the UP. He was in the Bear Grease, and so a lot of the same competitors come to these races. But yes, to answer your question, you definitely have to calibrate your strategy. There's no comparison, but it's just like human racing. You don't see Lance Armstrong. He's known for things like the Tour de France. I mean, that's what he's famous for. When we look at bike racing, we go, Lance Armstrong was dominant, basically sort of this godlike figure in that arena, whereas you get him on a 100-mile course or 250-mile legs, I mean, the sprinters run off and leave him. And dog mushing is very much like that. In the UP, I chose, because of the age group of my dogs, I was running a lot of new to racing 2-year-olds, I chose to be very conservative and run all of my middle distance races at the same pace that I would do the Bear Grease. That doesn't really cut it. In the UP, you have to, especially the UP, you have to amp them up a little bit and you have to crank. And to give you an example, I trotted my team up to Wetmore on the UP, which is the first checkpoint out of Marquette, and I got beat by half a dozen people by over an hour, which isn't a function of how fast my dogs can go. It's a function of how much faster those people are relative to me. It's just how much faster they're willing to let them go. So I guess my advice to UP drivers would just, you know, people who are doing well don't need my advice, but the people who want to go there and give it a shot, is that you have to be very careful about how you run the Bear Grease if you're going to turn around and go to the UP, and then you have to be aware of the fact that you have to go faster. You cannot do the UP at the same pace that the pace that wins the Bear Grease does not work at the UP. You have to speed them up.
Great. And again, about how you come back on the Bear Grease, does that mean that you have a lot of head-ons?
No, I kind of wondered about that too. Well, number one, this year, most of the people, well, okay, let me think about that a little bit. I've run it twice, and
You were probably in the back at the beginning, so, I mean, you were probably still in the back of the pack as you got to that point, correct?
Yeah, I did run into somebody, and I did this year, no, I did not run into anybody. I happened to kind of replay my memory bank. I did run into a lot of people. I ran into a lot of head-ons, because it's not just on the way out and the way back. You have this thing called the State Trail, and you're running along on the North Shore, and a lot of these towns, like Beaver Bay, for instance, you actually deviate from the main trail, and like you're heading to, say, the one end of the trail. Well, if you have a checkpoint like Beaver Bay, you would take a right-hand turn upbound. You'd take a right-hand turn, run down to the shore of Lake Superior and be in the town of Beaver Bay. Well, then you check in and you rest or don't rest or just whatever your strategy is. You turn around and come back out. You do meet people. It's like 7 miles back up to the main trail where you would get back up on the state trail and continue on towards your destination. That aspect, you do see a lot of head-ons. I, you know, and I'm kind of processing this. There were several spots where I ran into John Stetson, who was the fellow who was the runner-up to me in the Bear Grease. Fantastic driver, a lot of really good dogs, great attitude, and just a good competitor. I ran into him head on like 3 or 4 times in scenarios like that. It wasn't precisely because I was going out while they were coming back, or I was going out, you know, coming back while they were going out. It was more of these little dog legs that come off of the main trail. And that was pretty, it was kind of fun because, you know, anytime you get to see some of your buddies out there and like get to wave and say hi. And I mean, there was one time John and I met each other and I estimated, it took me a while to figure this out, but I estimated it's probably about 4 or 5 hours travel time in front of me. Like I was going out, he was coming back, and I still had to go around this big old long loop to kind of get back to where at the point where I met him. We actually stopped and talked for a couple minutes. I mean, I met him, and I was like, John, I thought I was on the wrong trail. It was dark, and I didn't know where I was, and I'm like, whoa, John. He stops. It was kind of like one of those Grey Poupon moments, you know, like, pardon me. But John assured me that I was on the right trail. We chatted for about a minute, and then we continued on our merry ways, and it was like 4 hours later before I got back to the point where I could see the tracks and, you know, where we had stopped. So there was a lot of that now that you bring it to mind.
Well, I want to ask, and I kind of know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So with head-ons and passing in your level of racing, is that just like a no biggie? I mean, like...
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a great one, even if, you know, some of us know the answer to that, because there's a lot of people who don't, is that, you know, one thing that's very nice about the Can-Am, the UP, and the Bear Grease Trail is that they're wide. They're, like the Bear Grease in particular, is a very wide open sort of highway of a trail. It's very well groomed. And there's a lot of room for people to kind of miss each other. So the races down here, I mean, for me, no. There's no, my dog team passes like being on the freeway or something. I mean, I just blow sure. past. But a good friend of mine, Mike Bestian, who races out there out of Minnesota, they're in 2008, I don't have necklines, and I don't put double necklines on my leaders. So I just run without necklines. And I'm running along. And Mike, of course, at this point, I didn't know it. I found out later he had been lost, and he'd been off the trail for a while, and he was getting back on the trail when I met him, and it was dark, and I run into him, and my leaders, one decided, we just sort of like zeroed in on each other, and he was trying to go by, but one of my leaders went on the left of his leaders, and one went on the right, and we just sort of split the difference and piled into each other, and I didn't know Mike at the time. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. I mean, it was like such a rank thing to do, you know, rank amateur thing to do, and I was just like apologizing to him, and I don't even know if he knew, you know, he may just now be figuring out who that was listening to this podcast. Like, that was you? There is that, but for the most part, the trail's wide enough. We just kind of go, all of us can just pass easily. I've never run into anybody that's got a mean dog, any shark, even though there's a lot of drivers who go to these races who don't finish in the high profile positions, but are very professional. I mean, I just think of the world of them. I mean, there's a lot of drivers who just maybe aren't competitive. They don't have quite the pace that they need to go to win these races or finish in the top five, but that are out there like, really putting a couple thousand miles of training and making sure their dogs are all do all the things like pass and camp and, you know, all the stuff you would expect. There's a great high degree of professionals that come to those three races. I mean, I consider those three very worthy races, and that was what I did this year, and I had a lot of fun doing it. I made a lot of good friends.
What made you want to get into the Bear Grease? How many times have you run it now?
I've run it twice. Well, I like to go meet new people, and a lot of these races are kind of club races. A lot of people, you know, if they're in Minnesota, they do the Bear Grease, and maybe they get as far as Michigan to do the, you know, the 250, the UP, never come out and do the Race of Sky in Montana. Or if they're from Montana, they just do the Race of Sky and some local races, but they never would go to the Can-Am. And, you know, we're not even getting into Canada and Alaska is, you know, so like to some extent I try to break that mold. So I try to go to different races just to meet new people and sort of spread the brand around a bit. Mm. But also, you know, our kennel here hits all over the map. We try not to be isolated. I try to make sure that people know. I want people in New England to know that it's a possibility. I may come out there and I may race you. I'm not going to just stay here where you get a free pass because you're so far away. Is that I want people to know, and that's how Harm and I differentiate ourselves. And one of the reasons why our kennel is so powerful is that we go to the Iditarod and we race. And this is an important thing I think that I hope people got out of this year, is even though I didn't win the UP or the Can-Am, I was in play to win them. I almost won them. I was very close to winning them. There was no other team in the lower 48 who could theoretically be in play to win all three of those races. And why that's important and why relates to, say, a bid for winning the Iditarod or the Quest in the future, is because it shows a team and an organization that can hit, and it can hit hard anywhere, anytime, under any rule set, on any trail, any format, against any competitor. And going to the Bear Grease is just sort of systemic of that, wanting to show that confidence and that attitude, is that, you know, I want to be able to say to the industry down here, this part of the industry, that I am very confident to load my dogs in the truck, drive them for 20 hours, and then be in your race on your home territory that's the antithesis of my training trails, and show you that my dogs, my brand, my philosophy, my whole thing, my Conover Enterprises, is a dominant force. Deal with it in some way. That's just the competitor and, you know, and us talking. But that's how I make a living, so that's a very important aspect of what we do. And the Bear Grease, size being fun and a great race, it's an opportunity for me to show everybody that my kennel is a powerful force that probably you should be interacting with if you want to have some of that kind of success for yourself.
Jason, when you look at, you know, as far as statistics and numbers, are you a large kennel? Are you, you know, 200 dogs strong? Are you 50 dogs strong?
Oh, no. Well, no. Is that what? Well, I don't know what kennel I am. I'll give you the numbers. We probably hover in there at about 75. But that's counting puppies. That's counting old retirees. That's counting dogs that right now I've got a group of about, I'm rounding up a lot of dogs. We're selling a lot of dogs in Ontario this year, and Michigan, and in Minnesota. And I'm actually on my way out there in about 2 weeks, very close to where you guys are, to make some delivery. So the number kind of goes up and down. I might take 15 of them out to the Midwest, but we're having puppies too, so that kind of replenishes the numbers. I mean, I hang in there. We call it a 75 dog lot.
There you go. And I think we're going to see you.
You are.
Yeah.
Sherry Sutherby invited me out. I'm going to be at Mansalona, Michigan, and I'm not quite clear on where that's at. It's below, just below the bridge. I was showing off my UP knowledge, and I said,
no,
so, Sherry Sutherby, I said, so you're a troll.
No,
and there's
no.
Long pause.
like,
oops, what?
We're in Cadillac, and you're staying and speaking
north.
In about 45
yeah.
minutes, really.
Yeah.
So about 2 hours under the bridge.
So you're
okay.
Definitely going to be in Trollville, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Forward
great.
To it. Yeah, Sherry Sutherby's having a good lineup this year. She's having Jason and Dee Dee and
Ryan
Reddington.
And Tim Riley.
Yeah, so be a fun thing. But let's just jump back really quick to the Bear Grease. Can you give us a little bit of the history of the Bear Grease? I know it's got some fun things that it does, like with the mail route. And
yeah, that race is, there's a kind of correlation between that and the Iditarod in that regard, is that it's a mail route. It's an old, it's a venerable mail route. It venerates the tradition and the history, which is just rich, of John Bear Grease, who was a man who you basically was the mail guy. He was doing four or five dogs, and he would take several hundred pounds of mail from one end of that trail to the other. And, you know, all those were like little villages, and, you know, places like Beaver Bay and Toffee were just like little villages, and he was delivering the mail. I don't presume to know his whole story, but it's one that's lived on through the years, which is kind of an amazing feat that a man can have such an impact on a community and a trail system that he is. The reason, John Bear Grease, is the reason and the inspiration for this event that brings together thousands of people from around the world. I think it sort of typifies what is amazing about dog mushing in general. One of the things that we do just to commemorate the John Bear Grease tradition is we carry the mail, and every year it seems like we drop it off in a different area. This year we carry the beautiful mail bags. I mean, it's like an old, authentic looking. It's reproduction, but I mean, it looks very authentic mail bag. And there's a lot of schools and whatnot put envelopes in there. So you have about 2 or 3 pounds, 4 pounds of this mail, and you carry. And I think this year we dropped it off, paid our respects to at the gravesite of in Beaver Bay of John Bear Grease. And some years we don't. I think in some years you'll find that we don't get a chance. That the trail won't allow us, the weather won't allow us to go down to Beaver Bay, so they'll kind of move around where the mail gets dropped off. But yeah, that's a very traditional aspect, and I would say it's a central sort of hub that the competitive part of the race, the Bear Grease race, revolves around, is that tradition.
And Jason, you know, a lot of the Iditarod's pretty famous because you can go to the different checkpoints, you can go to the ceremonial starts, and you can do the different things. How's the Bear Grease in spectators? Do you see a lot of spectators along the trail?
Well, it's certainly available to the spectators, and I would say yes compared to most races, but, you know, I can't really tell you. This is going to sound kind of funny, I think, maybe even lame. I can't tell you what some of these places, how you would even get to some of these places. I've only seen them by dog team. I mean, I know I can drive with my eyes closed practically to Duluth from here, but once you leave Duluth, I don't know what spectators have to go through to get to some of these checkpoints, but I do know they're all on a highway system. There's only one that they don't allow you to go to, spectators at Sawbill. Upbound. It's a bush checkpoint. They try to keep that as a fortnighted rod qualifier. But the rest of the checkpoints are all accessible by the highway. And one that really stood out this year was the one that was Two Harbors, Highway 2, that's very closer to, you know, kind of close to the finish line. There were several school buses came. Teachers brought a whole load of kids, like first and second graders, to it's this huge parking lot where the checkpoint is held. And I had like a crowd of reporters and children from the local schools. I'm not sure what schools they came from. I'm thinking Two Harbors. I was interviewed by some young high school gals that were part of like the journalist, the Two Harbors High School Journalist Club. And there must have been 500 spectators came. And then finish line, of course, is down. It's kind of like just above Duluth there in Billy's Bar. There's like hundreds, if not thousands, of people turned out. It's incredible. And one thing that really kind of stuck out, too, was I was going along this year, and I was between Highway 2 and the finish line. I'm going along, kind of just, you know, just basically planning my next race at this point. And I met this group of snow machiners, and they all stopped their snow machines. There must have been 20 of them, and they stood up on their snow machines, and they gave me this sort of standing ovation as I went by. You know, there's just this kind of, and these were just recreational. I mean, these are just people out there just recreating. And, you know, they kind of just knew that, well, today's the day the race finishes, and this is the first dog musher we're meeting, so he must be winning, and that's cool. So they stand up and they're like giving me the standing ovation. I mean, it was like that. I kept meeting these groups of snow machiners. Same thing. Everybody would stop and give me the standing ovation. I mean, I felt like honored. It was this really wonderful community feeling with that race, which is setting some of that competitive stuff I cited before aside. That quality we're talking about, the people coming to the race, the checkpoints, especially the ones kind of closer to Duluth, and just how everybody treats you on the trail, and just the love that's present in that, the pride and love that's present from the community, is what is going to keep me coming back.
That's wonderful. You know, that makes all the difference in the world, especially from the spectator side, and to know that the race isn't about just the competition. It's also about the community and about, you know, helping others and remembering famous people, but also what the effort and the character that they had put into the race. So it's kind of cool.
Upholding the tradition of John Bear Grease.
Yep, absolutely.
That's awesome. Okay, so now we want you to think really quick on your feet of one of your best stories. Even when you were a kid or like 2 weeks ago.
Anything that's happened. We love to hear good old
things. Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you one right off the top of my head because it gives me a chance to now I'm going to deviate from the lower 48 racing. I'm going to go back. I'm going to bring the scope back up to Alaska. 2002, we'll just go back to the 2002 Harm, who at that point was not my wife yet. We were just in love and together, and we were heading towards our marriage. At that point, we weren't really sure about that, but it's how it ended up is that we were on the 2002 Iditarod. I ran my rookie year in the Iditarod in 1993, and then I kind of drifted away from professional dog mushing there for a few years and just kind of dinked around. And when I met Harm, neither one of us really had a dog team. In 1995, we sort of got together and put together the team that became Conib Enterprises. Well, fast forward back up to 2002, and Harm and I had a couple of yearling teams. We were running the Iditarod that year with the Doug Swingley. That was the year he sort of decided not to be competitive and ran what he was calling his victory lap at that point, but he was running with us in the back of the pack. We were running like a long, not so much slow. We were running pretty fast, but we were taking a lot of rest and did the puppy trip to Nome, 13 days. Anyway, and this is one of the little adventures out there. At this point, Harm and I were just having a lot of fun, and I hadn't seen the Iditarod Trail in almost 10 years. And Doug was running with us, and he was giving us all his advice, and we were just taking an insane amount of rest. We would take off from one checkpoint like Finger Lake, and we'd spend the night there, and you know, we'd just roar over to. We'd just like roar to Ringy Pass, and we'd sit there for 5 or 6 hours, and then we'd just roar over to Roan and spend the night. And that year, there was just hardly any snow out in the burn. The gorge was just horrifying, and especially so because our teams were so jacked up with all this rest. And of course, crazy yearlings, and I don't even know how Doug did it. His team was phenomenal, and he should have been up there in the front of the race, and he was back there on a 13-day pace with us, acting kind of like this tour guide. And we're sitting in Roan, and he goes, which is this little cabin on the Delta. It was kind of the Delta. Two or three sort of rivers come to a confluence right there, and it's just this gravel and ice and stumps and windblown stuff. It's gorgeous, but very dangerous from a mushing point of view. It's hard to tell where to go. It's hard to make the dogs go where you want them to go. And Doug is kind of scaring us a little bit. He's been giving us all this advice on what the trail is going to be like. And here's when there's a thing called the glacier, he tells us. When you go about 12 miles out of Roan, we're going to come to this thing called the glacier. And no matter what else, I don't care what the markers tell you, you stay to the right. And I kind of remembered the glacier from back in 93, but not really. And I don't know if your audience has heard about this, but there's this place about 12 miles out of Roan that there's like a, it's like a little canyon, and basically what happens is it glaciates all winter, and sometimes it's not that bad, but sometimes it's quite horrible, and it's like about 200 yards long. It's quite an incline, and it's sculpted kind of like the West Yellowstone sulfur formations, where it's but slick, really slick. Anyway, long story short, Doug's telling us, no matter what happens, you get to that canyon and you stay to the right, even if you got to get out and lead your leaders. So he takes off and he runs off and leaves us. It was early in the morning. We take off, and Harm and I are traveling together, and Doug was in front of us, and Daniel Vetch, who was running the puppy team for Doug, was traveling behind us. So we were going along, and we're getting closer and closer and closer to that spot where he had told us to look out for, and you're climbing up this big, long stretch of hill, and then we hear this just commotion up in front of us. His dogs are barking and screaming, and I hear some cursing and just this ruckus, you know. I'm like, what? So we come out in this little clearing, and we're looking at the glacier, and Doug is up there, and he's just in this giant ball. The barkers all go to the left, and they kind of go across the foot of this glacier, and then kind of up along this really severe embankment on the left-hand side where it's just like shale rocks that, you know, kind of like where the ice terminates against the rocks, and then just like this steep cliff up, kind of leading up and away from it. There's no real good way to climb this glacier from what we can see, but he is insisting on going up the right-hand side, just like he had told us. But the problem was, I could tell as a rookie that this was not going to happen. He was on his knees getting dragged around. The dogs were, he'd kind of drag them up, and they would sort of like, well, everybody would lose their footing, and the whole team, 16-dog team, would kind of come sliding back down, just turning into this big mess. And we couldn't proceed, Harm and I, she's right behind me, we couldn't really proceed because of he's essentially plugging up the trail. You don't know if you're going to get kind of try to go by him, and his team's going to come down and crash into yours or what. And I was in a position where I anchored my sled off to like a little twig that was sticking up out of the glacier, and Harm was able to go behind me and start heading. This is after like 20 minutes of watching Doug floundering around up there, and, you know, cursing, and just, I mean, it was just like turning into this like kind of funny if it weren't so serious. And the problem is, to give people a little bit of a history or a little bit of an idea of what this is that where the worst part of the glacier is bad enough, but what is below us, we climbed a series of hills, what is below us is this draw just keeps on going down, and the glacier just kind of keeps going down to this river that we had left. It's probably about 300 feet below us, and it's just, the glacier is just like roots and stumps and rocks and stuff sticking up out of it. I mean, it's this kind of horrifying thing to look down there and realize what a mess that would be if your dogs went down into it. And long story short is that I'm sort of like paralyzed with inaction. I don't know how to proceed, and Harm takes the initiative, and she's trying to get her team to go across. Daniel had caught us, and she's trying to go across the foot of this glacier and bypass Doug and follow the markers through the shale and on up around. And Daniel was in front of her, she was behind, and her leaders got up to, Doug made some sort of exclamation, I won't even say what it was, but he was hollering at his dogs, and it spooked out Harm's leaders, and they turned around and started back down the glacier at this point. And I'm just in a position, I mean, I can't leave my team. I'm just watching this. He's about 100 feet from me. There must be 50 dogs there, 60 dogs barking and screaming. And her team turns around and basically just starts charging down the glacier off the trail and out of sight. And, I mean, at a dead run. I mean, it was like watching someone that's tied to the train tracks in front of the train. My jaw dropped open. My heart is probably stopped. I mean, I had white hairs came popping out. I could feel them. And I have this image that printed in my mind of Daniel, and Daniel was this 18-year-old kid who was just full of, you know, full of beans, and his cold weather hat was, he had like one of those, like, it's just like this big purple fuzzy thing sticking up. Well, he had stopped his team, and he was trying to grab for Harm's leaders when they bolted on her, and I sort of have this image of, it's like frozen in my eyeballs, of Daniel, like, just racing after Harm. Harm's team is bolting. He's racing after Harm to try to render some assistance. I'm watching this whole thing completely just like it was just useless. And Harm is like screaming, whoa. And it occurred to me to close my eyes. Watching her race down this hill. I'm like, I don't want to watch. My future wife. It would have been life ending. It would have been race ending, if not life ending. And Harm, she has this, she has the presence of mind to realize the brake isn't going to stop her, and she has a snow hook, and she leaps off of the sled. Now, this took a lot of guts. I mean, this is still amazing to me when I look back on it, because this is very factual. She left the sled at this, I mean, we're talking a dead run. I mean, these guys are flying down this glacier. She leaps off the sled, holding both hands on the snow hook, and just does this flying leap, skittering out across the ice as she's crashing down amongst these stumps and rocks and all this stuff, and grabs what turned out to be later, there's like a little root sticking up out of the ice, and mean, just brought that whole team. It was pretty strong because, I mean, that team just jerked off its feet. I mean, they were one second they were at a dead run, the next second it was like kaboom. I mean, the dogs were like, their feet went out from under them. The team stuff came flying out of her sled. I mean, she stopped so hard that her sled bag came open and just like half the contents went flying out. And I mean, it was like watching a car wreck. And it was because she basically had to take this flying football, like, you know, sort of an NFL touchdown leap across the goal line to get her hook into this one tiny little target. I still don't know how she did it. And a lot of people wouldn't have, because it's sort of more natural to stay frozen to the handlebars and just hoping that your brake is going to stop, which clearly wasn't. Anyway, so that kind of just turned into this debacle. And that's one story that, I mean, that's just one of our little adventures. We had so many adventures on that race. I could just go on about it. But that's one that really stuck to mind. Doug's up there cursing and hollering at his dogs. It's like the guy who he thinks of himself as the best dog musher has ever stepped on the back of a runner's, you know, four-time Iditarod champion. He's like cursing and he's created this huge problem for himself. I'm paralyzed through an action. I'm watching my wife disappear over this glacier while I'm standing with my jaw open. And she's like doing this heroic leap to stop her team. And I will say this in all seriousness, if she hadn't made that, if that hadn't worked, she and the team would have been gone.
So I mean, how long did it take you to open your eyes?
How long it took to break the suction off my pants. It took a while. And then I was able, you know, the thing with my team was not able, I couldn't really get away from it to render assistance. But after that, it kind of worked out because she just got all, Harm is very stubborn, and she just got kind of pissed and went up there, grabbed her leaders, got her stuff back in her bag, grabbed her leaders, just like, get out of my way, and just, you know.
I can hear it.
Yeah, I mean, she basically was furious at Doug at that point, just like, you, God, get out of the way. And, you know, basically we all got to the top. And the funny, it just, I mean, I could go on and on and on about those stories, but that's one that stuck. That's the one that really stuck out.
And yet we continue to keep doing this crazy sport, don't we?
Yeah, that's we sure do. That glacier, for anyone who's listening, you can either commiserate or maybe someday see it yourself for the first time and recognize that that some of that story was something could happen to you.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, is there anything else that you have a passion about or anything else that we missed that you'd like to talk about, Jason?
Well, I'm passionate about a number of things, but one of them is I'm passionate about being an American, proud American, passionate conservative. But one of the things that I think that most people are gonna see if they go to that website is I'm a passionate writer. We have this department in ConnaughtEnterprises.com called Jason's Journal, and you click on that and you go in there and you're gonna see some of the stories that I've written, and they're little short stories. I don't want to bore anybody, but they're little sort of eclectic pages out of my family's mushing or mushing related history. And I'm very passionate about it, and I think it's something you're going to be seeing a lot more of in the future. Now that we have this website, I'm going to just start turning these out at a regular basis.
Great.
So I advise anyone who's listened to this and is curious to have a look. You're going to see a site of dog mushing and dog mushing lifestyle that nobody else has really written about, I don't think.
Okay, I'm always curious. They're in the middle of nowhere with a little bit of water, generators maybe. How do you get internet to put up your website?
Well, we had the option of getting a satellite out here. I mean, that satellite dish, that was an option. But the local telephone company, when we have telephone, I'm talking on telephone, the local telephone company provides DSL, which is incredible. We didn't realize that, and we just were floundering around trying to figure out how we were going to do this internet connection. And we were informed, well, we do have DSL, you guys. We had it about 2 years. I'm like, what? Nice. Can you get it out here? So we got the DSL, and it's just blazingly fast. We're six miles off the end of the trunk, and it's amazing. I mean, it really is a fast connection, and that's pretty, makes things easy.
Well, yes, we're in the big metropolis of Cadillac, Michigan, and we can't get DSL. We're 12 miles out, so yeah.
All right. Well, there's nothing else, Jason. This was a great interview.
Thank you so much.
You'll be kicking us off to our new season and appeasing a lot of our listeners. And I know that they will be thrilled to have this as our initial interview of 2009. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. I had a lot of fun. Ask that if you use anything of his, just convey that copyright image. That's what he would appreciate.
Absolutely. We appreciate him so much. So that's absolutely for sure. So, Jason, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. I've had a lot of fun. It's great to get to know you guys.
Have a great day. And as soon as you and your brothers want to get on a podcast, we'll start that conservative podcast.
Okay, well, let's stay in touch.
All right, thanks.
Great interview, huh, Gene?
Yep, I loved it.
There's that word great again.
I know. You need to, like, go to thesaurus. Yeah.
Yes, it is a very wonderful, I think it was
great.
Wonderful last year. So,
awesome.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Neat. So it's interesting. I don't know what I would do if I saw you running headlong, full bore, over the edge of a glacier.
And I don't know that I would be as smart as Harmony to jump off with my snow hook. Honestly, I'm not sure I'm that. I don't know. I do know that I would have been like Harmony when she did secure her team and got really mad, because every time that I've ever bit it or lost my sled or anything like that, anger seems to be the first emotion that I feel. So I was going along with that, but I don't know if I would have been that smart. I really don't
just
know
what. Just to leap
what
off the sled with your snow hook in hand, hoping that you can drop it somewhere. You know, it's one of those things that I love to hear stories like that, because it kind of puts the
gives
image,
you an idea of what to do.
Well, yeah, it gives you the idea what to do, and it kind of allows you to experience that situation without actually being in that situation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
So if we are ever in that position or even close to that position, you realize that, hey, the only thing that you might be able to do is dive off and try to sink that snow.
Well, I believe we receive things all along our journey.
Yeah.
And we can either take those things and kind of put them in our backpack and carry them with us, or we can forget about them, and when those times come, we don't know what to do. And shame on us for not sticking them in our backpack and carrying them along with us.
Nice.
You know, it's that
forbearing.
You don't even know what forbearing means, do you?
So anyways, a couple
it's
of...
It's the podcast that you don't want to forbear. What does forbear mean, Mr. Dewey?
Well, it's when there's one more than three bears. Right? There's four
bears.
See,
we tease Tim all the time at home. We make him, like, try and tell us grammar things and all that.
You
and
know, we homeschool, so it's like, they always ask me, Dad, what's an adverb? And I'm like, I don't know what an adverb is.
Anyway, just for all you that are trying to tell Tim what forbear means, it means to avoid. So it is the podcast that you don't want to avoid, young man.
Podcast that you do want to avoid. Wait a minute, what are you saying?
Nah.
Hey, and I also want to do a shout out. There is a new podcast on the scene. One of our dear friends, Greg Salentin, up at Mushing Magazine, is doing podcast also. So if you get a chance, pop up to Mushing Magazine. That's mushing.com, and I think it's right on his homepage. You can click and listen to a couple of episodes. He's also got an interview with Jason. So if you get a chance, pop up there and give Greg some encouragement, because I think there's plenty of ear space for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And by all means, if you are in the vicinity of Mansalona, Michigan in August.
Mansalona.
Come on over.
It's a wonderful
place. We will be
place.
There. We will be there.
Yes.
So
podcasting
if you really
live.
Want to see what we look like, and then get really scared, then, you know, you'll see there. We have every intention of being there, don't we not?
Yes, we do. It's a great place. So I really encourage you, if you guys are within, you know, four or five states of Mansalona, it's a great time. Dee Dee, I guess, is just a fantastic, wonderful speaker. Jason is just going to light the whole crowd up, I think.
Yep.
I've never really got to talk to Ryan before, but I'm
maybe
just
we'll
really
be
excited.
Putting him on a podcast before then.
And you know what's neat about the event? It's not like they come in and you sit with them for 2 hours and then they leave. I mean, they are literally there for 2 or 3 days, and you get to
hang out.
I mean,
yeah,
so
it's fun.
Last year when Lance Mackey was there, it was just an incredible opportunity to not only hear neat and interesting stories, but to ask him questions, to talk to him about what's life like up in Alaska outside of the mushing times, and, you know, generators and fuel. I mean, just the thousand things, you know, even down to people were bringing in and asking him about camp stoves. And it was just really exciting to hear all the gambit. And I can't even imagine having Jason, Ryan, and Dee Dee there.
Yeah,
it's just going to be awesome.
Fun.
So.
All right, well, we just welcome you back and pass the word around about Sled Dog Podcast. We are alive. We have come out of hibernation. And also, don't forget to go use the Amazon link from our site. So you go on to Sled Dog Podcast, and if you got anything to buy from Amazon, just do the affiliated link through our site so we can earn some pennies.
So, hey, we appreciate you guys all. Feel free to write us at Tim at Sled Dog Podcast.
Gina at Sled Dog Podcast.
And that's Gena at SledDogPodcast.com.
Yes,
and thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next episode.